This is Embodied, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. How comfortable are you talking about porn? Does it make you embarrassed, ashamed? If you knew more about how porn is made and how to navigate your own exploration of pleasure, would you still blush at the mention of it? Today on Embodied, we are going to take a look at the adult industry and drag all the shame we feel when talking about it into the light. We're going to start with Durham-based artist Monet Noel Marshall. Her forthcoming digital exhibit, Shameless Pleasure, explores the relationship between people and their porn preferences. Monet, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Anita. How are you?
Good, good. And I just want to give a quick content warning to our listeners. If you have not figured it out already, we are going to be spending the hour discussing adult themes, including sexuality, arousal, and pornography. So if you prefer to listen later, you can find this show at our website, stateofthings.org, also on our podcast feed. But if you are listening now, feel free to join the conversation by tweeting at us with a hashtag embodiedWUNC. So Monet, this is a massive topic, one that people have been thinking about and exploring artistically for many years. Tell me about how your own relationship with porn sparked your idea for this new virtual project.
Well, as an artist and someone that so much of my art comes from a vulnerable place, I'm always interested in the parts of ourselves that we still feel like we need to hide. Mm. And porn is definitely one of those places, you know? It's something that we don't necessarily announce that we watch it. We definitely don't tell people what we're watching and the specifics of our enjoyment. We turn the volume down or have our headphones on in the dark. And I'm just curious about what happens when we do the opposite, where we talk about it out loud.
Yeah, we're going to explore that today and kind of see what happens as we go through it all together. So when you put out this survey, you were asking people, you know, what is your relationship to porn? What do you watch? Tell me about what you wanted to know and then what you heard, what you learned.
Yeah, I wanted to know, one, what people are watching, just because I find that really interesting around, like, what brings us pleasure and the diversity in that. And then I also want to know, but more importantly, I wanted to know the shame that we carry around it and what brings us shame and what are the seeds of that shame. And so much of what I learned is that as diverse of a porn search we have, the buckets that bring us shame are actually so small. We actually carry a lot of the same shame, no matter if we are someone who, like someone in Nigeria or someone in Chapel Hill, so many folks are carrying the same shame. And I found that so enlightening, and also that we can work through it together because it's all the same stuff.
What is that shame that people are carrying? What are those buckets that kept coming to the forefront?
Religion was a big one. Another one was feminism. Folks had shame around wondering if they're a good feminist if they watch porn. Another was their porn search topics don't match their own perceived sexuality. Another one's like shame around telling their partners, like, well, the porn I watch doesn't match with what my partner looks like, and I don't want them to think I don't desire them. There was a question around ethical porn. I know you're going to get into that later. Is the porn I'm watching being made well? Are the people being treated well and paid well? So those are some of the topics that came up.
I want to get into the one about religion first. You're someone who grew up in the South and know very much kind of how sex is talked about and how it's not talked about here. We've talked a lot on Embodied about sex ed. And in this state, North Carolina had abstinence-only sex ed until 2009. So it's been a long time that we haven't talked openly about the kinds of sex people are having or ways to protect yourself or how to think broadly about sexuality. So for you growing up here, what were the religious kind of narratives that you inherited around sex? And how do you think that informed your own understanding of your sexuality?
Well, first I want to say I grew up on Long Island, New York.
Oh, that's right. You've just been here for so long.
Right. But it was very much the same. I grew up going to church. My mother grew up in Greenville, North Carolina. So I definitely still got a lot of that Southern, Christian belief. And even from folks who were not Southern, they still carried a lot of the same thing. So I would say that, you know, sex is between a man and a woman. They are married. And then that's it. Like what you do in your, there's no other conversation around desire or self-pleasure or like how to navigate those things, how to communicate our desires. And so then you get out in the world and you learn that a lot of folks are not actually living that way. Like, no, that's fine if people are, but most folks are not. How do you navigate that? And then that piece of like, well, every time I do this, because I've been taught that sex is between a married man and a married woman, that I'm wrong. So then there's all that guilt that comes up. And it's just not helpful. It's not helpful for us to live our healthy lives. I think that it gets in the way of us having safe sex. It gets in the way of us asking for what we want. And then that shame, then like, I feel like shame is, can be its own epidemic. Like once it's in one part of our lives, it can like bridge out to other parts, you know?
So as you went around and talked to people kind of as a process of putting this together, what did you learn from them about kind of the need to disrupt those narratives?
I learned that a lot of people do not want to talk about it, but for those that do, they really want to. Because it's just like whenever you ask someone a question they've never been asked before, and you see their eyes light up, and then they're figuring out how to put words to this thing that's been inside them, I think that's really powerful. And what I learned is that people want to know what pleasures other people, and also they want to know that they're not alone. I think because that shame is so quiet, particularly around subjects of porn and sexuality, it makes us feel like we are the only one experiencing this thing. I'm the only one that feels shame. I'm the only one that doesn't know how to communicate my needs. I'm the only one that enjoys this sort of porn, and it's just not true, right? But because we can't talk about it, it then makes us feel alone, and then that becomes a cycle of shame. So I think people want to disrupt that cycle and to be able to step out and find other people to dismantle the shame and also to celebrate in the pleasure too.
Did you learn anything that would help you respond to people's concern who say, "Can I be a feminist and watch porn?"
Yeah. I think that for one, we have to be able to acknowledge what brings us pleasure. And for me, my feminism is working to get me more free. And anytime that there's a box that's telling me one that like, oh, I can't do this or like that doesn't feel like freedom to me. I think there are definitely ways that we can make sure and push to make sure that our porn industry is safe for all of the performers and the workers and directors and creators and watchers. I think there's ways for us to do that, but there should be no, my feminism shouldn't tell me that my desires are wrong. And I think that's a great place to start.
So what is this exhibit going to look like? It's going to be on Instagram. How are you going to capture all of this diverse, rich complexity through image? Or what are you going to do? What is the exhibit going to look like?
Absolutely. So on the exhibit, once we open in June, it will you'll be let in. So just like an art opening, it'll open at like 7 o'clock. And then you'll see these images of t-shirts. So when I thought about doing this live, when I did the survey, I wanted to print the shame messages on t-shirts, and then in a black light or a glow in the dark, then would be the, I'm sorry, the porn search terms would be in on the t-shirt, and then in black and white, in glow in the dark, I'm sorry, would be the shame messages. So as you walk through, you'll see an image with the porn search terms. You swipe to see the next image, and that'll be the shame topic. And then, so that'll be on each side. And then in the middle will be quotes, resources, places to learn more. And also, I've been doing interviews with different people around porn and shame and pleasure, such as a Black queer sex ethicist, a kink coach, a local artist, creator, Omi Sade Bernie Scott, who also has a podcast as a Black woman over 50. So just talking to different people about their relationship to porn and shame and pleasure.
So what's the account that we should follow that's going to open up and show us all of these narratives?
It's Shameless Pleasure.
Shameless pleasure. Okay. I only have about a minute left, but I would love to just kind of end on a personal note for you. As you have moved through your own journey and as you have learned narratives and learned about other people's experiences for this project, what is the biggest shift that you have had in your own understanding of pleasure?
That I deserve it and that I don't have to be ashamed of the things that bring me joy. Because as we know, there are lots of things that bring us down right now, and we deserve and get to be in deeply inside of our own pleasure.
Wonderful. Monet Noel Marshall is a Durham-based artist. You can find her forthcoming virtual exhibit, Shameless Pleasure, on Instagram. Monet, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anita. Have a great day.
You too. Joining me now is Lynn Camella. She's an associate professor of gender and sexuality at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She's also the author of Vibrator Nation, How Feminist Sex Toy Stores Changed the Business of Pleasure. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. And we want to hear from anyone who is listening. You can join the conversation by tweeting at us with a hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. We are also streaming the show live on Facebook, so feel free to watch it there. So when we say the adult industry, there are so many things that come to mind. There's the content that you can access on your phone immediately without a paywall. There are films. There are things you can rent. There's deep, long, huge history and massive industry. We've said multi-billion dollars. So can you just kind of give us an overview of the landscape? What do we mean when we say porn and this industry?
Well, I mean, I think you're exactly right. It's a kind of very broad, all-encompassing term. But, you know, there wasn't always an adult industry. I mean, to kind of take us back, you know, five decades, the adult industry as an industry really began to form and organize into some kind of recognizable entity towards the late 1960s. And that was the result of many things. It was the result of loosening of obscenity laws. It was a result of the countercultural movements of the 1960s that put sex and gender on the map in new kinds of ways. Certainly, you know, throughout the 20th century, there were stag films, there were explicit moving images, there were art films and the nudie cuties in the 50s and 60s. But it really wasn't until the late 60s where something that we would call the adult industry existed. And the kind of dominant medium throughout the 70s and the early 80s, what's often referred to as pornography's golden era, was film. And, you know, often plot-driven, shown widely in adult movie theaters, so public screenings of films. And then certainly by the early 1980s, the industry started to shift, driven largely by technological shifts with the advent of VHS. And so there was a different medium that was introduced. It was cheaper to shoot. Screening moved from public theaters into the privacy of one's home. But what also started to happen with the VHS revolution was that because it was less expensive to make explicit movies, more people were picking up video cameras and making the types of films that they wanted to see. So it's that era where we start to see new kinds of filmmakers moving into the adult industry, making different kinds of films for new kinds of audiences. So the first, you know, what we would refer to as early pioneering feminist porn makers really came out of that era in the 1980s, where there were new technology literally, you know, at their fingertips that they could, you know, shoot. Today, as you noted, you know, there's so many things that people think of when they think of porn. It's not just obviously film. It's not VHS. It's not even DVD. We have this whole world of online pornography driven by the internet, and we have, adult webcamming sites, which are booming. We have clip sites that are increasingly popular, and that allows a lot more control for performers. So we have this whole new generation of performer producers that are kind of making their own content, taking care of their own lighting, taking care of their own editing, taking care of the back end of, you know, different websites to upload it.
I want to pause you there for a second and kind of break that. So, I mean, you mentioned kind of in the 80s as the barrier to entry is lower, people can get in, they can start creating content, maybe shooting content told from a different perspective to accentuate the different kinds of fantasies that people have, creating content that is not just created from a male gaze, which had been kind of predominantly the people that had dominated the field until then. But then the internet really, really changes the game. And I want to kind of pause there for a second, because just to kind of meet listeners where they are, because a lot of the focus kind of media content around porn has a lot to do with the internet and how the internet has shifted the kinds of porn that's accessible and the access to it, and a lot of concerns that people have about what it means to be able to access porn this easily, and maybe what it means for younger viewers to be able to access porn this easily. And kind of that is not the focus of this show, but I do want to touch on that briefly. Kind of the research that exists about the effect that this widespread access to porn has on people. I wonder how you respond to that research as someone embedded in this field.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we would call effects research, I mean, it's very uneven. You mm-hmm. know, there's not a consensus around the effects of pornography. And, you know, that's true of a lot of media effects research. It's difficult to isolate variables, all that kind of stuff. But I do think, you know, the internet did kind of make it easier for all sorts of people to access pornography. And there is, as you note, a lot of concern around young people's easy access to pornography and the ways in which that is influencing, shaping their ideas about intimacy and their ideas about kind of sexuality and relationships as well. And, you know, there are a lot of kind of groups that oppose pornography that are increasingly concerned, for example, about public health effects. That idea has really gained traction in different states that have called to eradicate porn based on perceived public health effects. So those concerns are out there regardless of what the research is saying. And I do think, you know, one of the important pieces in terms of discussions about pornography and young people that I think really has to be on the table is that it continues to be the case that in the United States, overall, we have absolutely abysmal sex education. There's just a lack of comprehensive, accurate sex education for young people. And so they turn to other venues to, you know, learn about sex. And so I do think for a lot of young people, they default to pornography. So I think, you know, we need more porn literacy, not just for young people, but for adults as well. And by porn literacy, I mean kind of curriculum-based programs that really kind of break down how kind of porn images are created, what they are, how they work. But I think porn literacy also has to include discussions of consent. They have to include discussions about intimacy and about, you know, kind of healthy relationships. So I understand the concerns. I think a lot of historically opposition to pornography has been driven by a lot of morality campaigns, a lot of shame-based responses. I mean, to go back to your first guest, I thought it was an amazing conversation to really focus on shame, but to also focus on our lack of conversations around sex and sexuality and how important it is in terms of combating shame to have opportunities for people of all ages to be able to talk about, you know, the complexities of their desire.
Yeah.
Whether that's, you know, their porn viewing or whether it's just like, I'm, you know, going through puberty and having these feelings that I've never experienced before, and there's nowhere for me to go to make sense of them. So I think it's really important when we talk about pornography to also just kind of acknowledge our deep deficits as a nation when it comes to not only comprehensive sex education, but open and frank conversations about sex and sexuality.
Definitely. And we really are trying to look today at, you know, those creators who are trying to diversify the landscape and create content that is really centered around consent and safety and fairness. And to get us started on that part of the conversation, I want to bring in another guest, Shine Louise Houston. She's the founding producer and director of Pink and White Productions. Her company aims to highlight authentic female and queer sexuality. Shine, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. So I would love for you to talk about this notion of ethical pornography and what it means to you. What does it mean to you to kind of create porn that is based on a particular kind of ethical standard?
Okay. To start off, I have my soapbox about the term ethical porn. I feel like it really polarizes the industry. You know, I'm just as much of the industry as, you know, like Vivid or any other big company. I'm in that pool. I am not different from them. So to say that some people are ethical implies that the rest of the industry is unethical. And, you know, that throws a lot of really awesome people under the bus, and I don't feel comfortable with that. But there's been a lot of buzzwords over the years, and I find, like, yes, in a marketing sense, a lot of people want to say, hey, we're different, we work differently, da-da-da-da, and that's totally fine. You know, there's been couples porn, you know, like women's porn, made for women. There's been, you know, dyke porn, feminist porn, and now we have ethical porn. So there's a history of labels for a section of the industry to be like, hey, we work a little differently.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that they are better. We're just different. You know, the industry is not a monolith. The industry is incredibly diverse. But I don't want to put too much weight on these labels.
So when you got into the industry, I'd love to know about kind of what your intentions are as a creator. Like, what is the kind of content that you're hoping to create? And what are the relationships that you set up with producers to create that content?
When I started with the original movie, like The Crash Pad, I had been working at Good Vibrations, which as at the time was like a worker-owned kind of like co-op before it was labeled as women-owned. And what I was seeing was, you know, like a lot of queer folks were coming in and being like, hey, what can I watch that kind of looks representative of my community? And at the time, there weren't terribly many, you know, titles with that type of representation. So around 2004, 2005, I decided to go ahead and jump in. You know, I have a film degree. I was at Good Vibes for about five and a half years. So that was, I felt like that was a good, a lot of market research.
That's a sex toy store.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I felt like I kind of had an understanding what was out there, and we decided to fill that gap. Ha ha. So right off the bat, several things are important, you know, important of like different body representations, different gender expression representations. And something that was interesting that was happening around that time was I feel like there was a renaissance of porn. There was like dyke porn was a big thing. And I swear to God, like everybody and their mother was doing porn for their, you know, college thesis. And then suddenly it all disappeared. Porno chic just disappeared. So that's around the time when we created The Crash Pad. And I wanted to be sustainable. I didn't want to be like everybody else who like did one title, two titles, and like disappeared. I was like, we need something that's like consistent. You know, something that's just as consistent as, you know, you know, lesbian MILFs 1 through 257. You know what I mean?
Well, but talk about that, because there is this concern that people have that there is porn out there that they perceive as degrading, degrading to the performers, degrading to the viewers. So how do you set up an environment with the people that you're working with to make sure that the things that they're creating are things that they are comfortable with and things that make them feel safe?
Okay, so that's kind of pointed, assuming that a lot of stuff out there is already is totally degrading. I think what people forget is that there's actually a lot of discussion about what's about to happen on set and how it's going to happen. And the performers do a lot of negotiation. You know, and I'm talking about more mainstream stuff, like stuff that's, you know, it doesn't even matter if it's like cream pies or like circle jerks or anything like that. Everybody has talked about what's happening. And, you know, you might find that action degrading, but there are some people who are like, wow, that was like my biggest fantasy. That was awesome. You know, and it might not be my style of shooting or might not be like my fantasy, but just to put it out there, but just because some things are for the particular viewer hard to watch or like, I'm not too sure if I'm into that, I'm not going to necessarily label that degrading.
Right. Well, I guess. Yeah, I mean,
to
I just.
Your question on how we work on set is I work a little bit differently on set just because I'm looking for a particular type of performance. I would say I'm into a more like, you know, I would say that there's different styles of performance. And what I push people to do is what I would say an honest performance. So I don't direct the talent. The talent decides what they want to do for the day. And I direct the cameras. And then in post, I create a cohesive narrative of what happened, also to the trying to be as honest to what actually happened that day as possible.
So, Lynn, I want to bring you back into the conversation for a second and get to this question around the distinction between fantasy, reality, desire, and maybe help people understand kind of that distinction between what you want for real life, how you want people to treat you in your relationships, what you want society to look like, and maybe what you desire in your fantasies and what brings you pleasure and how to kind of make sense of that distinction. I only have about a minute, but if you could get that conversation started.
Oh my gosh, a minute. I mean, that's a really huge question. And I don't claim to kind of be, you know, someone working in social psychology, right, who might be kind of studying, you know, how people navigate, you know, fantasies and integrate them or not with the rest of their life, right? I mean, it's an absolutely, you know, interesting question, but huge and complicated. And again, I mean, I think oftentimes, you know, to kind of go back to this notion of shame, is that I think, you know, part of the thing that gets in the way of people really being able to make sense of what they might desire, right? Monique talked about, you know, this guilt that some of her interviewees had. Can I be a feminist if I watch this kind of porn? Or my search terms online when I search for porn don't really match what I might do in my personal private life. And I think, you know, we again, for a lot of people, porn is presented to them from a very young age as something incredibly taboo and stigmatizing. And that is a really difficult thing for a lot of adults to get over. So they harbor this guilt, right? And for some people, you know, venturing into the taboo or the illicit is a real turn on. For other people, you know, there's a lot for them to reconcile, forget about their fantasies, just watching porn in general. Is really a practice that can be quite shrouded in shame and shrouded in guilt. And so, you know, I'm kind of sidestepping your bigger question because I don't have a great answer for that. But I think part of the problem in that, you know, maybe kind of gap between kind of fantasy and, you know, how people negotiate that or not is just the limitations of living in a sex-negative culture.
We have one more guest we want to bring into this conversation, but I want to quickly talk with you both about consumer responsibility. So if there are people out there who want to make sure that as a consumer they are consuming porn in a way that is supporting porn that is created in a space where there are standards around safety and giving creators autonomy and making sure that they feel good about the content that they're creating. Shine, what do you recommend for those people? What is the way to find that content?
I think the first thing to do as a consumer is to pay for your porn. If you are engaging in the part of the industry where there is kind of like an economic cycle, then you are part of the chain of ethics. If you are paying for your porn, guess what? That means that the company gets to continue to produce porn. People are getting paid, and they're getting paid a decent wage. And just to put it out there, you know, the majority, you know, the industry at large, there are systems in place for everybody's safety. You know, I don't know if people really understand, you know, the lengths that the industry goes to people to keep people safe. You know, we have the PASS system. People get tested every 2 weeks. They have a panel that tests from everything from, you know, syphilis, chlamydia, you know, to HIV. We have a really, really good system for, like, if somebody tests positive, the whole industry shuts down. There's contact tracing. Those people that they shot with, they're tested. You know, and if all those people come up negative, great. You know, and then we have protocols on how to handle that person and, you know, how to get that person care. If somebody test positive, it's actually really interesting because people are like, wow, this is a great, we should be doing this with COVID. Mm. You know, people are actually looking to the adult industry on how we handle, you know, basically containing viruses and looking at the industry as an example. Because at the moment, you know, we know that our nation does not have a cohesive plan to handle the situation. I was actually in a meeting yesterday where the industry came together and we're looking for a cohesive plan and talking about when and if people can reopen, you know, and doing that unified. So, you know, the industry takes a lot of precautions. So if you are buying into that part of the industry where that economic cycle is, that's the first step in being ethical. You know, there are places you can go. There's GameLink. There's AEBN. If you like a performer, find their OnlyFans, find their ManyVids, you know, and pay them directly. But I feel like it starts with the consumer.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, as far as like ethics on set, I think, you know, the mainstream is not like operating in a dark basement. You know what I mean? And it's just like one guy with a camera. It's not like that. It's a full production, and you know, everything that you expect on a lot of film sets is still the same on a larger porn set. I myself am like, you know, we have food, we have barriers, you know, you can get tested, we communicate about risk. So, you know, all these things are happening on set, you know, in that economic system where, you know, the money is actually flowing.
Right.
If you're going to places like Pornhub, guess what? You're breaking that economic chain. And now you're hurting the industry and you're hurting talent. And you're hurting the possibility of keeping people safe.
Okay, I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now, and we are going to talk about the audio erotica app Dipsy. It is trying to change the narratives around pleasure and sex, and let's listen to a sample of one of their narrative stories.
So, who's that guy you were with at the bar yesterday?
Oh, so you do remember me.
I couldn't keep my eyes off you.
Huh. Yeah, he's just a friend.
Yeah?
I try to keep things casual.
So, he wouldn't mind if I kissed you right now? She flicked her eyes up and down me again.
He might.
Joining me now is Gina Gutierrez, the co-founder and CEO of Dipsy. Gina, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course.
What an intro.
Of course. Yeah, playing your content right back to you. So, tell me the story behind Dipsy and how this came to be.
Yeah, I was really fascinated by the idea that my community of people, when you ask the question, where do you go for erotic content, didn't really have good answers. There was a lot of, well, I've looked a lot and I've seen a lot that I don't want to see, and that prevented me from keeping looking. You hear a lot of, oh, I have this one chapter from this one book that I think is really sexy, and that's kind of been it. You hear a lot of kind of grim options and a lack of options. And that to me indicated that there was more to be done. There were different ways into creating erotic content, and I was really inspired by creating something that felt really safe and different and accessible and approachable. I was just really intrigued by what that could be, what those differences could be. And one night I was listening to Headspace, and it struck me that audio had a really interesting potential to be really immersive, felt really safe and kind of, you know, in your own mind, in your own thoughts. And also that it's so deeply imaginative, and it opened up this realm of creating erotic content where you could imagine, you know, those two characters pretty much however you want to imagine them and in whatever space you want to imagine them in. And so we create blueprints for people to layer on their own imagination onto.
Tell me about consent. You mentioned that and the importance for you of creating content in which people felt safe listening and felt like the people involved in it were consenting to those actions. How do you write narrative stories that are erotic and pleasure-centered and really make sure to incorporate consent?
Yeah, I think people assume that consent is a barrier, that consent slows things down, makes things awkward. And we were really intent on proving that that isn't necessarily the case, that consent isn't like this one way to do it and non-consent is another way to do it. There's actually a huge range of gray between there, and how to actually layer it in thoughtfully means modeling it. And so, you know, how many blog posts or activists or celebrities have we heard talk about consent? And it sounds like a task list. But when you actually hear people integrate consent into their actual, you know, realistic sounding encounters, you suddenly start to see, oh, like that's a phrase I could use. That's intonation that could happen. That's the way that you might weave that in. And it feels really natural. And so it's really exciting for us, even though we don't, you know, position our content as educational. I think people are excited to hear these things interwoven in a way that feels replicable for them in their own lives.
Shine, how do you model consent in the content that you create? And I guess a big part of that is context. Maybe talk about the talkbacks that you do with some of the creators that you film after the film itself is done.
There's a lot of ways that we incorporate consent. Obviously, before the cameras are running, there's a lot of conversation. While the cameras are running, whether it's a vanilla scene or there's any BDSM, when we edit, we keep in those moments where like, hey, is this okay? Would you like to stop? I'm going to get a check in. Do you know what I mean? So like I keep that in the edit so you can see how that seamlessly kind of goes into the play. We also do a post interview and we talk about what people liked, what people thought was challenging. We discuss what their safer sex decisions were for that scene. And sometimes people talk about that stuff, like what they do in their personal life as well. So it's really interesting. And over the years, we have like, you know, hundreds of these conversations. And it's interesting, the responses that stay the same. And it's very interesting to see the responses that have changed over the years. And I think the biggest buzzword that comes up more is consent and communication. Hmm. And like how consent and communication is actually a safer sex practice. So, you know, communicating what your risk is. Do you know, like, well, do you feel comfortable with using barriers? Do you feel comfortable with not using barriers? Or if we're not using barriers, what things would you like to do without barriers? So there's a lot of talk about how communication is a safe sex practice, not just barriers or not just like contraception and, you know, like in pill form or in like barrier form. So it's interesting. Like I have a lot of hope for future generations. Like I'm really excited about like what people talk about now.
Gina, with Dipsy, you all also have this entire section that is self-guided and really encouraging people to explore their own sexuality, think about what their own boundaries are, think about what their own preferences are, what makes them uncomfortable and uncomfortable, and how to articulate that. Tell me about adding that section to the app and what you all are really trying to do with that.
Yeah, I think overall with Dipsy, both our narrative and our guided content, we are hopeful to move sex out of vice and move it more towards into the idea of wellness or a whole and healthy life. I think it's interesting that meditation, a practice that has existed for millennia, is now something that is newly approachable to people because they've been given an inroads into it. I think in many ways, healthy sexuality is the same. What are the ways that I can integrate that into my real life or into the content that I consume? And so the two parts of our content library are both designed to be supportive of one another. Ideally, you know, you might listen to a certain story and really like the way that the characters interact. Say it's a more BDSM style story and you're like, wow, it's really interesting to incorporate aftercare into my sexual practices. Well, then we have a couple guided pieces led by experts in those spaces to say, hey, here's how you actually might go about integrating that into your life in a more tactical way. And guided content and audio is also really exciting because it allows us to lean on the medium in all the ways we lean on it in narrative as well, because it is so intimate and immersive. It allows you to learn in real time. So something like guided massage with a partner can be something that you engage in real time as you listen, hands-free, which is really exciting.
Well, I guess, and Lynn Kamala, gender and sexuality studies professor, I want to bring you back into the conversation here to kind of add some context for people who may hear all of this, but still feel like there are aspects of this industry, you know, that make them uncomfortable, or they're having a hard time separating, again, that question that I asked you toward the end of the last segment, kind of what they want in real life versus what they may be interested in fantasy. And I wonder if you can just kind of maybe help us understand the importance of understanding pleasure kind of in its own realm and approaching porn as something that is existing in this realm of fantasy. It is an experience. It is curated. It is not meant to be sex ed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that an important part of pleasure, and I think this has historically been really, really true for a lot of women, is, you know, this idea that you have permission to explore your pleasure. Sometimes we don't know in advance what we might like, what we don't like, until we download that app and listen to some audio erotica, or we go to, you know, Shine's website and watch a little bit of the porn that's created by her company, with, you know, the kind of considerations that she and her crew keep front and center. So I think that, you know, someone who's listening to this, who might be like, I don't know, I'm still unconvinced, it's really important to remember that adult content is extremely diverse. And I think, you know, Shine nailed it earlier in the program where she, you know, underscored the fact that the porn industry is not a monolith.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has historically been so much available out there, but it's easy for people to forget that or to never even realize that, because what the media oftentimes covers is, you know, kind of porn gets lumped into, you know, one kind of quote unquote mainstream hardcore sexual activity that's inherently degrading to the people who participate in it. And so I think, you know, this idea of pleasure is worth kind of exploring, that you are entitled to explore your pleasure. That's something that feminists in the 1970s worked so hard to communicate with people. That's something that businesses such as Good Vibrations that Shine mentioned, this legendary sex toy store in San Francisco, has historically worked hard to communicate to their customers of all genders and all sexual orientations. Pleasure is your birthright.
Hmm.
You know, that was a mantra at Good Vibrations. And I think that's an important mantra for people to remember. The pleasure is your birthright. You're entitled to accurate sex information. You're entitled to explore your sexuality. It doesn't mean that everything you watch or listen to or try is going to be something you want to watch or listen to or try again.
Yeah.
But you're entitled, particularly as an adult, to explore adult entertainment as part of your sexual exploration.
I only have about 1 minute of the show left, but I guess I'd love to just hear briefly from you, Shine, and then from you, Gina, about the narrative around pleasure that you would be most excited to disrupt, the most common narrative that you hear that you would like to disrupt. Shine?
It's kind of funny. I come at everything as a filmmaker. So it's hard for me to be like, pleasure, 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 because really what I care about is like film. But to answer a question that you didn't ask, I'd really like people to watch porn just like another film genre, and have that same suspension of disbelief. When you watch a Marvel Universe movie, you know, and you see all those special effects, you're not going like, oh my God, how'd they do that? And how are those people all safe? You know, there's you understand that aspect. You've learned how to watch movies. I think, you know, it was pointed out before, there needs to be porn literacy. You've learned all your life how to watch movies. I think we should be learning how to watch porn. And with that same, like, right, I know that behind the scenes, all this other stuff has happened. So now I can let go and I can have my suspension of disbelief and enjoy what I'm watching without cringing, because I know it's make-believe. And I know, like, porn is, you know, marketed as this is real, this is authentic. It's film. It's not real. It's fantasy. Even amateur stuff, even stuff that I make is constructed, you know?
Okay. Yeah. I hear you. I hear you. Gina, I want to give you 20 seconds. How about for you?
Yeah. I think for me, it's clear that pleasure is a huge and misunderstood part about the conversation that needs to happen around female empowerment, especially. I think empowerment has become a buzzword, just like consent has become a buzzword, but ultimately what it means is imbuing previously marginalized communities with power, and pleasure is access to power. Accessing pleasure is access to power, and that is just so much bigger than just the topics that we're covering today. It's about life itself.
All right. Thank you so much to all three of my guests, Gina Gutierrez, CEO and co-founder of Dipsy, Shine Louise Houston, founding producer and director of Pink and White Productions, and Lynn Camella, gender and sexuality studies associate professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. You can find more about them and the rest of our Embodied series at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, Stacia Brown, and Josie Taurus. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Wodarski also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.